land and all that. Yet what I mean to say is, one did not expect General Lee.
To be a gentleman, Longstreet said.
Fremantle squinted. After a moment, he nodded. Longstreet was not offended. Fremantle said wonderingly, Sir, you cannot imagine the surprise. One hears all these stories of Indians and massacres and lean backwoodsmen with 10-foot rifles and rain dancers and whatnot, and yet here, your officers. He shook his head. Extraordinary. Why, do you know your General Lee is even a member of the Church of England?
True.
He has great forebears.
Yes, Longstreet said.
I have noticed, sir, that you are always in camp near him. I must say, sir, that I am touched.
Well, Longstreet said.
Ah, Fremantle sighed. We have so many things in common, your country and mine. I earnestly hope we shall become allies. Yet I feel you do not need us. But I must say I am increasingly indebted to you for your hospitality.
Our pleasure.
Fremantle cocked his head again. One thing I'm very glad to see, your General Lee is a moralist, as are all true gentlemen, of course. But he respects minor vice, harmless vice, when he finds it in others. Now that's the mark of the true gentleman. That is what distinguishes the man so to me. Aside from his military prowess, of course. The true gentleman has no vices, but he allows you your own.
Ah.
He patted a saddlebag. By which I mean, sir, to get to the heart of the matter, that I have a flagon of brandy at your disposal. Should the occasion arise?
It undoubtedly will. Longstreet bowed. Thank you.
You may call on me, sir. Longstreet smiled. A small weakness, Fremantle went on cheerily, of which I am not proud, you understand, but one sees so little whiskey in this army. Amazing.
Lee's example. Jackson didn't drink either. Nor does Stuart.
Fremantle shook his head in wonder. Oh, by the way, there's a story going around, you know. They say that General Lee was asleep, and the army was marching by, and 15,000 men went by on tiptoe so as not to wake him. Is that true?
Might have been, Longstreet chuckled. I know one that I heard myself. A while ago we sat around a fire, talked on Darwin. Evolution. You read about it? Charles Darwin. Theory of evolution.
Can't say that I have. There are so many of these things rattling about.
Theory that claims that men are descended from apes.
Oh, that! Oh, yes. Well, I've heard distastefully of that.
Well, we were talking on that. Finally agreed that Darwin was probably right. And one fella said, with great dignity, he said, Well, maybe you are come from an ape, and maybe I am come from an ape, but General Lee, he didn't come from no ape.
Well, of course.
Fremantle did not quite see the humor. Longstreet grinned into the dark.
It is a Christian army, Longstreet said. You did not know Jackson.
No. It was my great misfortune to arrive after his death. They tell great things of him.
He was colorful, Longstreet said. He was Christian.
His reputation exceeds that of Lee.
Well, pay no attention to that. But he was a good soldier. He could move troops. He knew how to hate.
Longstreet thought.
A good Christian.
He remembered suddenly the day Jackson had come upon some of his troops, letting a valiant Yankee color sergeant withdraw after a great fight.
The men refused to fire at him. That man had been brave. He deserved to live.
Jackson said, I don't want them brave. I want them dead.
They tell many stories of the man. I regret not having known him.
He loved to chew lemon.
Longstreet said.
Lemons?
Don't know where he got them. He loved them. I remember him that way, sitting on a fence, chewing a lemon, his finger in the air.
Fremantle stared.
He had a finger shot away, Longstreet explained. When he held it down, the blood would get into it and hurt him. So he would hold it up in the air and ride a talk with his arm held up, not noticing it. It was a sight, until you got used to it. Dick Ewell thought he was crazy. Ewell is rather odd himself. He told me Jackson told him that he never ate pepper because it weakened his left leg.
Fremantle's mouth was open.
I'm serious, Longstreet said amiably. A little eccentricity is a help to a general. It helps with the newspapers. The women love it, too. Southern women like their men religious and a little mad. That's why they fall in love with preachers.
Fremantle was not following.
Longstreet said, he knew how to fight, Jackson did. A.P. Hill is good, too. He wears a red shirt when he's going into battle. It's an interesting army. You've met George Pickett? Oh, yes. Perfume and all, Longstreet chuckled. It's a hell of an army.
But thinking of Pickett last in line reminded him of Pickett's two brigade commanders, Garnett and Armstead. Old Armstead, torn by the war away from his beloved friend Win Hancock, who was undoubtedly waiting ahead on that black hill beyond Gettysburg. Armstead would be thinking of that tonight. And then there was Dick Garnett.
Pickett's men are extraordinary men, Fremantle said. The Virginians seem different, quite, from the Texans, or the soldiers from Mississippi. Is that true, do you think, sir?
Yes. Have you met Dick Garnett?
Ah, yes. Tall fella. Rather dark. Wounded leg. Odd, that.
Jackson tried to court-martial him, for cowardice in the face of the enemy. I've known Garnett for 20 years. No coward. But his honor is gone. You will hear bad things from people who know nothing. I want you to know the truth. Jackson was a hard man.
Fremantle nodded silently.
He also court-martialed A.P. Hill once, and Lee simply overlooked it. Well, come to think of it, I had some trouble with old Powell myself once. He wanted to fight me a duel. Matter of honor. I ignored him. It's an interesting army. Only Lee could hold it together. But the thing about Garnett troubles me. He thinks his honor is gone.
A tragic thing, Fremantle said.
There was tact there, a tone of caution.
The papers, of course, all side with Jackson.
Longstreet blew out a breath.
And Jackson is dead. So now Garnett will have to die bravely to erase the stain.
And he saw that Fremantle agreed. Only thing for a gentleman to do. Longstreet shook his head. A weary bitterness fogged his brain. He knew Garnett would die. No help for it now. Unturnable, ridiculous, doomed with a festering, unseen wound. Fremantle said,
"You are not Virginia-born, sir?"
"South Carolina," Longstreet said.
"Ah, that's in the far south, isn't it, sir?"
"True," Longstreet said. He was weary of talk. "Honor," he said. "Honor without intelligence is a disaster. Honor could lose the war."
Fremantle was vaguely shocked.
"Sir?"
"Listen, let me tell you something. I appreciate honor and bravery and courage. Before God. But the point of the war is not to show how brave you are and how you can die in a manly fashion, face to the enemy. God knows it's easy to die. Anybody can die."
In the darkness he could not see Fremantle's face. He talked to darkness.
Let me explain this. Try to see this. When we were all young, they fought in a simple way. They faced each other out in the open, usually across a field. One side came running. The other got one shot in, from a close distance, because the rifle wasn't very good at a distance. Because it wasn't a rifle. Then, after that one shot, they hit together hand to hand, or sword to sword, and the cavalry would ride in from one angle or another. That's the truth, isn't it? In the old days, they fought from a distance with bows and arrows and ran at each other man to man with swords. But now, listen. Now, it's quite a bit different, and quite a few people don't seem to know that yet. But we're learning. Look. Right now, take a man with a good rifle. A good man with a good rifle, which has a good range, and may even be a repeater. He can kill at, conservatively 200-300 yards, shooting into a crowd attacking him. Forget the cannon. Just put one man behind a tree. You can hardly see him from 200 yards away, but he can see you. And shoot. And shoot again. How many men do you think it will take to get to that man behind a tree, in a ditch, defended by a cannon, if you have to cross an open field to get him? How many men? Well, I've figured it. At least 3. And he'll kill at least 2. The way you do it is this. One man fires while one man is moving, and the other is loading and getting ready to move. That's how the 3 men attack. There's always one moving and one firing. That way you can do it. If you forget the cannon. But you'll lose one man most probably on the way across the field. At least 1. Probably 2. Against a cannon, you'll lose all 3 no matter what you do. And that's across the field. Now, if you are attacking uphill...
He broke it off. No point in talking this way to a foreigner. Might have to fight him sometime. But the man would not see. Longstreet had spoken to his own officers. They found what he said vaguely shameful. Defense. When Lee dug trenches around Richmond, they called him derisively the King of Spades. Longstreet took a deep breath and let it go, remembering again that damned Black Hill, fires like eyes. Fremantle said, bewildered,
"But, sir, there is the example of Solferino, and, of course, the charge of the Light Brigade."
"Yes," Longstreet said.
Like all Englishmen and most Southerners, Fremantle would rather lose the war than his dignity. Dick Garnet would die, and die smiling. Had he his hurts before? Aye. Then he died like a man. Longstreet, who had invented a transverse trench which no one would use, filed the matter forcefully in the dark cavern of his swelling brain and rode into camp. That night, at supper, someone remarked casually that since the army needed ammunition, wouldn't it be proper for the ammunition factories to stay open on Sunday? Most of the officers agreed that it had not yet come to that. Longstreet stayed up talking as long as there was company, as long as there was a fire. Because when the fire was gone and the dark had truly come, there was no way he could avoid the dead faces of his children. 6. Lee. Lee rode north through the town and out the Heidlersburg Road. There was a joy in the night all around him. The men yelled and whooped as he passed by. Many stopped and just smiled, and some took off their hats. They had won again. The joy on their faces, the look of incredible pride, the way so many of them looked at him going by as if waiting for some sign of his approval of a job well done, another fight so nobly fought. Lights in all the starry young eyes, and beyond that the way some of them had tears in their eyes as he went by. Tears for him. For the cause, for the dead of the day. The sight of it was something very nearly unbearable, and he set his face and rode through saying nothing,
nodding, touching his hat. Then he was out the other side of town, and there were piles of stacked Union muskets, blankets, and canteens and wagons, the abandoned implements of war. Ewell had made his headquarters in a farmhouse. He was there, along with Early and Rhodes. They were all standing at a white gate as Lee rode up at the beginning of the night, enough light still in the sky so that the black mass of the hill to the east, the untaken hill, could still be seen against the evening sky. Lee thought, "Why did you not attack? Why?" But he said nothing. Ewell had the look of a great-beaked, hopping bird. He was bald and scrawny. His voice piped and squeaked like cracking eggshells. He had lost a leg at Manassas and had just recently returned to the army. And he was standing awkwardly balancing himself against the unfamiliar leg and scratching his head and swaying nervously, clutching a fence post. Early stood beside him, dark, formal, composed. Rhodes, off to the side, bowed formally at Lee's approach. "Good evening, sir. God bless you. Did you see them run? Did you see them? We whipped them again, by God. Yes, sir, we did, sir." Ewell chattered. Lee sensed a strange thin quality in his voice, a wavery exuberance. He escorted Lee through the house, hobbling awkwardly on the wooden leg, talking about the bullet that had hit him there that afternoon while he was mounted on his horse. They went out into an arbor and sat in the warm evening under the grapevines and the soft sky. And Ewell sat on the ground and hiked up his pants to show Lee where the bullet had hit, a minier ball just below the jointed knee, a vast gash of splintered white wood. Ewell was giggling, grinning, cocking his head off to the side like a huge parrot, chortling. Lee asked the condition of the corps, the number of wounded. Early spoke up. Ewell deferred. Early stood with his legs wide apart, his hands clasped behind his back, heavy in the jaw, his face bleak and grim, black beard dirty and untrimmed. He had been a West Pointer, had left the army to become a lawyer, a prosecutor. He was utterly sure of himself. Lee watched and listened. Early explained the situation coolly and logically. Behind him, Ewell nodded in punctuation, his head twitching, his fingers fluttering. Lee felt a strangeness in the air, a coolness. Ewell should speak for himself. Rhodes sat silently leaning forward, his hands on his knees, looking at the ground. There was a pause. Lee said, "I had hoped you would move on through the town and take that hill." Ewell blinked, rubbed his nose, looked at Early. Looked at Rhodes, patted his thigh. Lee, watching, felt a sudden acute depression. Ewell said, "I didn't think it was practical. We were waiting for many reasons. We had marched all day and fought, and your orders were a caution against bringing on a general engagement." He jabbered, rambling, moving about in his chair. Early walked over and sat on the railing of the arbor. Ewell turned to him for confirmation. Early said calmly, silently, bored, "There were reports of federal troops in the north. We couldn't bring artillery to bear, and no word came from Hill, as you know. We decided it would be best to wait for Johnson." "Yes, yes," Ewell nodded vigorously, thumping the wooden leg. "But he did not arrive until dark, just a while ago. He's out now, looking over the terrain." Ewell went on nodding. Lee looked at Rhodes, who said nothing. After a moment, Early said, "You may remember, sir, that I passed over this ground a few days ago and am familiar with it. The hill is named Cemetery Hill. It has another hill beyond it, also occupied. It will be a very strong position." Lee closed his eyes for a moment, was very tired. "Think of all of it later." An aide brought a cup of hot-boiled coffee, thick with sugar. Lee drank, revived, abruptly saw the face of Jackson in his mind, a flare of cold blue eyes. He looked up, blinked, could almost see him. Jackson was here,
Jackson was looking on. Ewell was drinking coffee. Early had folded his arms. Rhodes still gazed at the ground, plucking at one of his fingers. Lee said, "Can you attack on this flank in the morning?" Ewell sat up. Early did not move. Lee felt the depression, cold and slow and steady like a wind in his brain, shook his head to blow it away. Early said, "That hill will be a very strong position, once it is fortified, which they are doing right now."
"Very strong,"
Ewell nodded violently. "Have you looked over the ground, sir?" Early asked.
"From a distance."
Early leaned back into the dark. He spoke slowly, deliberately. "I do not think we should attack this point. This will be the strong point. Our troops have marched hard today and fought hard today. I suggest we hold here while the rest of the army makes an attack on the other flank."
"You think an attack here would succeed?"
"I think it would be very costly." Ewell nodded. Lee turned.
"General Rhodes?"
Rhodes looked up, glanced away, shrugged. "We'll attack, of course, but the men have had a good fight, and it will be a strong position." He looked up at Ewell, then quickly away. "I'm sorry we did not take it today."
"Well," Lee said, "today is done."
"General Longstreet has not been engaged," Early said. "His corps has not been fought for some time." He was referring to Chancellorsville, where Longstreet's men had been detached. "If he were to attack on the right, he would draw the enemy from this position, and we could then attempt the assault, supported, of course, by General Hill." Lee thought, "Longstreet cannot stand the man. I wonder why. Something too cold here. Something disagreeable in the silence of the eyes, the tilt of the head. Jubal. Strange name. Old Jubilee. Nothing happy about the man. And yet unmistakable competence." Lee said, "Longstreet proposes that we move our army to the right around the enemy flank and interpose between Meade and Washington."
"And vacate this position?"
Ewell popped his eyes, slapped the splintered wood again. "Leave this town, which we have just captured?" Lee said with some irritation, "The town is of no importance." Ewell looked Early. Early said slowly, "To move this entire corps in the face of a fortified enemy?" He smiled slightly, with a touch of the disdain for which he was rapidly becoming notorious.
"Hardly fitting," Ewell piped. "Hardly. Troops fought so hard for this town. Do we move them out and march them off into the woods in sight of the enemy?
Morale will suffer, General.
The boys are ready. Our boys are ready."
"Longstreet is on the defensive again," Early grinned. "I suppose that's to be expected, but really, sir, it seems to me we are here and the enemy is there. And Hill and General Ewell have engaged, and Longstreet has not. If Longstreet can be induced to attack on the right, we can give you this hill tomorrow by sundown." Ewell was nodding again, pointing at Early, wagging a bony finger. They talked. Lee made no decision. Must not judge Ewell now. The man had been a good soldier for too long. First day in command of the corps. Jackson's old corps. Hill is sick, Ewell indecisive, the hill untaken. Longstreet broods on defensive war. Lee said, "Would you gentlemen retreat?"
"Retreat? Retreat?"
Ewell sat with his mouth open. Rhodes looked up. "Would you suggest that we fall back behind South Mountain?"
"Retreat?"
Ewell was amazed.
"But why?"
Lee said, "If we do not withdraw, and if we do not maneuver in the face of the enemy, then we must attack. There is no other alternative." He rose, not waiting for an answer.
They accompanied him to the door. He saw a vase filled with flowers on a small wooden table, a picture of an old man frowned down out of an old round frame. Lee was thinking. Very dangerous to withdraw, to pull this army with all its trains back through that pass. Without cavalry, it cannot be done. Stuart, I have waited long enough. He thanked the men for their day's work, told them to get a good night's rest. Once again he saw Jackson's blue eyes probing, reproachful. He thought, General, we miss you. He rode off into the dark. Taylor was there with messages. Lee answered them. One to Imboden, one to Chilton. Sent Taylor off to find the raider, Harry Gilmore, who was with Johnson. He rode off with Venable and then, moving in out of the night to greet him, saw old Isaac Trimble, astride a pale horse, fiery old Isaac. Lee smiled a greeting. General Trimble was almost 60. Not much older than you, old man. But he looks ancient. Do I look that old? I was tired before, but I am not tired now. No pain now. God's blessing. What will I do about Ewell? Trimble said,
Sir, I beg your pardon, but I will not serve the man.
He was furious. He raised one huge hand like a vast claw and made a gesture as if pushing a disgusting thing away from him into the black air.
I will not serve the man. I am a volunteer aide with the man, sir, as you know. I most respectfully request another assignment.
He shook his head violently, almost displacing his hat.
The man is a disgrace. Have you heard it all, sir? What have they been telling you? Ask the aides, sir. Or General Gordon, or Johnson.
He went on. He was a marvelous old man who had sworn to be a major general or a corpse. Lee gathered that he was talking about Ewell. Lee calmed him, but he wanted to hear. Trimble said,
We should have taken that hill. God in his wisdom knows we could have taken that hill. Beyond Cemetery Hill there is another hill, and it was totally unoccupied. There was no one there at all, and it commanded the town. Gordon saw it, sir. He was with us, me and Gordon and Ewell, all standing there in a flaming dark like great fat idiots with that bloody damned hill empty. Begging your pardon, General, but that bloody damned hill was as bare as his bloody damned great head, and it commands the town. We all saw it, General. As God is my witness, ask anyone here. McKim was there. Smith was there. They were all there. I said, General Ewell, we have got to take that hill. General Jackson would not have stopped like this with the bluebellies on the run and plenty of light left and a hill like that empty as, oh, God help us, I don't know what. But nobody there at all. And the Federals running. No guns set up, nothing but one battery and one regiment in line.
He was running out of breath. Lee had stopped to listen. He sensed among the anger the bitter breath of truth. Trimble took off his hat and wiped it across his brow, and his white hair gleamed in the moonlight like wadded cotton. Lee said, Go on.
Yes, sir. Sir, I told him. General Ewell, I said to him, Sir, give me one division and I will take that hill. And he said nothing at all. He stood there. He stared at me. I said, General Ewell, give me one brigade and I will take that hill. I was becoming disturbed, sir. And General Ewell put his arms behind him and blinked. So I said, General, give me one regiment and I will take that hill. And he said nothing. He just shook his head. And I threw my sword down.
Trimble gestured helplessly, actually close to tears.
Down on the ground in front of him.
He raised both arms.
We could have done it, sir. A blind man should have seen it. Now they are working up there. You can hear the axes. Now in the morning many a good boy will die.
He wiped his face. It was all out of him. The fire died. He slumped forward in the saddle.
General, sir, I request another assignment.
Lee said softly. Thank you, General. You will be of great service. Thank you. Now that Trimble was quieter, Lee could question him. Dick Ewell had frozen. He had deferred to Early. Lee thought, I must look into this. He told Trimble to rest, and he rode back to his headquarters in the dark. He was becoming increasingly tired, but there was much to do. Food, get some fuel. The ancient body had no reserve. His chest was stuffed. A feeling of cool bleakness there, no strength in him. He thought of that, and of Stuart off somewhere, possibly dead, and of Ewell's weakness and Hill's illness, and the Union Army growing now in the night on that hill, blossoming darkly across the field like a fungus, a bristly fungus. The headquarters was in a small stone house on Seminary Ridge. An elderly woman, the resident, was cooking for him. Lee chatted with her politely, his mind on other things. While aides came and went, generals pushed in and out. Reporters and artists and the Prussian and the Austrian passed in and out. There was a rocking chair for Lee. It received him like an enfolding arm. Taylor appeared with a squad of men, led by a man named Waters, a Marylander. Now, late at night, it was becoming difficult to recognize people, to remember their names. Lee prepared sealed orders to be given to each of Waters' men. They were to scatter out over the countryside and find Stuart and get him back to Gettysburg with all possible speed. When that was done, Lee looked for Longstreet. But the stubborn face was not there. Lee closed his eyes. The uproar of jokes and joy went on around him. Must see Ewell now, without Early. He motioned to Marshall, sent for Ewell. The room gradually cleared. Lee signed orders. I do too much myself. He was thinking, retreat is not even an option. We must assault or maneuver. If we assault, Longstreet must bear the load. Lee took a quick nap. He was awakened by the arrival of Ewell. He rose and went out into the night. The strange beaked figure waited with deference. Lee said, How are you, sir?
I'm fine, sir. The leg troubles me a bit.
Lee suggested a doctor.
Ewell shook his head. Drugs injure a man's thinking. The leg is minor. Sir?
Johnson's men are in position now. He is very optimistic, much more than Early. I believe we ought to attack there, sir.
Attack the hill?
Yes, sir. Culp's Hill or Cemetery Hill or both, sir. There was a new certainty in his voice. Lee was very glad to hear it. A small relief blossomed like a flower. Lee said only, I have made no decision yet. But in your opinion, we should attack on your flank.
Yes, sir.
Lee nodded. I will consider it. I am glad to hear you are well.
General,
Ewell said. His face was not clear in the evening light, the lamplight from inside, the moon from the heavens. But there was a sadness in his voice, regret apparent in the motion of his head, the beak above the wild mustache bobbing.
I think I was too slow today, sir. I regret that very much. I was trying to be careful. I may have been too careful.
Lee was moved. My good old soldier. He was embarrassed. He said quickly, You won a victory, General. Ewell looked up. His eyes were strained. It was not a large victory. It might have been larger. We might have pushed harder. But it was a victory. I am satisfied. The men fought well. This was your first day. It is not as easy as it sometimes appears.
No, sir, Ewell said.
Now, get some rest. Lee sent him off. He went back into the stone house feeling much better. The old man had been a good soldier for too long. You cannot worry about Ewell. And then Lee thought, but sometimes I have seen it happen. A man loses part of himself, an arm, a leg, and though he has been a fine soldier, he is never quite the same again. He has lost nothing else visible, but there is a certain softness in the man thereafter, a slowness, a caution. I did not expect it with Ewell. I do not understand it. Very little of a man is in a hand or a leg. A man is in his spirit, and he has that in full no matter what part of his body dies, or all of it. But, Lee thought, you may not understand. It has not happened to you, so you don't understand. So don't judge. He was a good soldier. He is not Jackson. Jackson is gone. Not entirely gone. Jackson was there today, watching, and Ewell sees his eyes. But you cannot blame him for not being Jackson. You must make do with the tools God has given for the job. Richard Ewell, Old Baldy, and his ridiculous horse. Lee went back to the rocker. Midnight came, and he had not yet slept. Headquarters grew steadily more still. Lee thought again of Rooney Lee, wounded, and prayed for him. There was no time for a letter to his wife, that troubled woman. He closed his eyes and thought of Meade, out there gathering the army. John Reynolds was dead. He prayed for the soul of Reynolds. And in the morning, this is the great battle. Tomorrow, or the next day, this will determine the war. Virginia is here. All the South is here. What will you do tomorrow? No orders were out. Now he was alone. It was cooler. Taylor came and tucked a blanket around his knees, and Lee did not argue. He was drifting off. Longstreet would be up in the morning. Pickett would be up by late afternoon. In the afternoon, all the army will be here, and we will hit them. We will hit them with everything, and drive them right off that hill, and send them running back down the road to Washington. If Stuart's cavalry... He woke briefly. Without cavalry in the rear, no victory would be complete. Should we attack before Stuart comes? And if he comes with tired horses and weary men? If he comes at all? Don't think on that. Lee closed his eyes and let himself fall into the bright dark. For thine be the kingdom and the power. 7. Buford. He came back at last to the cemetery on the hill. All down the ridge they were digging in, all around the crest of the hill. He sat on the horse and watched the picks swinging in the moonlight, listened to the sounds of shovels in the earth. The army was still coming in, marching by moonlight. It was almost 2 o'clock in the morning. He rode slowly along the ridge looking for headquarters. He had been hit once in the left arm, and the bleeding had stopped, but the genuine pain was just beginning. They had wrapped the arm and put his coat back on, and he did not show the injury. He rode stiffly, dizzily, looking for someone to give him orders for what was left of his cavalry. He found a small farmhouse, center of many lights, many horses tethered outside. The musk of cigar smoke was heavy in the warm air. He remembered an old Indian joke, "Follow cigar smoke, fat men there." Bright moonlight, a warm and cloudless night. They were posting cannon along the ridge by moonlight, pleasant looming shapes, rolling caissons. Buford thought, "I need a drink. Whiskey stiffens." He rode to the farmhouse and stopped in a crowd of horses and sat there. Rather not get down. Men were passing in and out, much conversation. A cloud of officers had clustered by the small, lighted door looking in. One glanced up, saw him, noted the star, turned, saluted quickly. Buford wiggled a finger. The man came forward, a major. Other men were turning. Buford rode the horse almost to the door. Buford said, "Who's in command and where do I find him?" "Good evening, sir," a major said, a very high voice. A lisp? "The officer in command is General Howard, sir. He may be found..."
"Don't be a damn fool, Edgar," another man said. He saluted Buford. "Begging your pardon, sir, but the truth is that General Hancock is in command, and if you'll..."
Another major, skinny, grinning.
The first major said angrily, "I must remind you, sir, that General Howard is the senior officer on the field."
"But General Hancock has orders from General Meade himself."
They argued, ignoring Buford. He looked down in wonder. Other officers voiced opinions. Oliver Howard was the commander of the 11th Corps. He had arrived this morning with Reynolds. He had fought on the right and been broken, just as he had been broken at Chancellorsville. He was a one-armed man for whom Buford had no admiration. The majors confronted like wispy chickens. It was very strange. Behind them, Buford saw suddenly a familiar face, John Gibbon of Hancock's Corps, infantry. A cold, silent man. His brothers fought for the other side. Buford nodded. Gibbon nodded. A major was giving a lecture on military precedence. Howard could not be relieved except by written order or by Meade in person. Gibbon came up and took the reins.
"Evening, John." Buford bowed. "A hard day?"
"Long," Buford admitted.
"Hancock's inside if you want to see him."
Gibbon led the horse out of the crowd. The argument went on behind them. Buford watched it with awe.
"Never get used to it. The mind of headquarters, not if I live 1,000 years.
Gibbon said, "That's been going on all night. I gather Meade's not here yet. Who's in command?"
"Take your choice," Gibbon grinned.
But he was one of Hancock's fanatics. Good soldier.
"I have to refit my outfit," Buford said. "I need orders."
"Hancock got here late this afternoon just as Howard's corps was falling apart. They ran, them Dutchmen, just like they did at Chancellorsville.
Hancock took command and reformed them on this hill along with the first, and ever since then everybody's been coming to him for orders and not Howard, and he's hopping mad. Kind of funny. He claims he's senior officer," Gibbon chuckled. "But Hancock is a verbal order from Meade. It's all very funny. Thing is, when Hancock's on the field, the men naturally turn that way. Old Howard's really steamed."
"I just want orders," Buford said. "I'm kind of weary."
He was thinking, "Need the long quiet again. Want to get away from here." He dismounted, held briefly to the horse. Gibbon called a man to take the reins. He said,
"I'll get your orders. Why don't you wait out here?"
Buford sat on a rail. The arm was alive with pain. He said,
"Is the army here?"
"Just about, all but Sedgwick. We've got Sykes and Geary and Sickles along with Hancock. And Howard. Sedgwick will be here tomorrow, but he has a long march."
"Good," Buford said.
He nodded, closed his eyes. "Can relax now." He felt the beginning of sleep, even among the pain, the quiet dark coming, the soft, rolling, dreamless rest. Gibbon said, "They're all inside." Buford stirred, began to head toward the door. Gibbon said casually, "Why don't you stay out here?" Buford moved sleepily toward the door. "Need one last order, then a good long sleep." The aides near the door were parting, but something in Gibbon's voice caught him. He stopped, turned. Gibbon was there.
"Howard has made a complaint against you, John. He says you should have supported him on the right."
Buford nodded dumbly, then blinked. He raised a pained arm. Gibbon said, "He lost half his strength. Most of them got taken prisoner. He's mad as a hornet, looking for somebody to blame it on. I think he's picked you." Buford felt nothing for a moment.
a sort of sodden silence all through his brain. Then the anger began to rise like a metal wave, like a hot tide in the dark. Buford could say nothing. No words came. Gibbon said softly, "Stay out here, John. I'll tell Hancock you're here." He moved past Buford into the room. Buford blinked and blinked again and then began moving, pushing his way into the light, the smoke of the room. It was jammed with officers, all the brass. The anger made Buford dizzy. He tried to push his way through, and the pain went all the way up his arm and into his chest and shocked him stiff. He could see faces. Sickles, the bully boy, the bright politician, a fat cigar clamped in a fat mouth, the man who was famous for having shot his wife's lover. Geary and Sykes were sitting, brooding. That damned Howard was making a speech. And there was Hancock against a wall, writing a note, talking to aides, issuing orders. Buford's vision blurred. The room was very hot, and there was too much smoke. He had to push his way back out of the room into the open air. He kept saying aloud, "God damn him! God damn him!" He sat on a rail. In a moment, he looked up, and there was Hancock. "How are you, John?" Handsome face, watching. Buford focused. Hancock looked down with bright, dark eyes. Buford said, "I'm all right. Heard you were with John Reynolds when he died."
"I was."
"Tell me." Buford told him.
Hancock would write the letter.
"Good, very good."
Hancock was older since last time Buford saw him. Calm and cocky. Damn good-looking man. Buford felt suddenly better. Cool, clean air.
Hancock said, "I'm sending the body back to his folks in Lancaster. They might appreciate a note from you."
"I'll send it."
"How's your division?"
Buford told him.
Hancock was surprised. He hadn't known Buford was that involved.
Buford said, "We were involved."
"Well, get yourself refitted. May need you in the morning." There was commotion behind him. A mass of aides were riding up. Somebody blew a discordant bugle. Hancock stood up, grinned. Buford noted, "Why, Hancock's wearing a clean white shirt. Isn't that amazing? Clean as a whistle."
Hancock said, "Here's Meade."
They all came out to meet him, the angry man with the squeaky voice. They gathered around him as he dismounted. Buford was pushed to the side. He heard Meade greet Hancock.
"Damn dark. I can't see a damn thing."
Hancock said he was very glad to see the general. Meade said with great disgust,
"Well, I hope to God this is good ground, General." "Is it good ground?"
"Very good ground, General."
"Well, by God, it better be, because we're going to have to fight here sure enough in the morning."
Buford was pushed too far away. Meade went on into the house. Flocks of officers gathered at the windows. Buford had enough. He had his orders. He got back on his horse and rode slowly back toward the cemetery. He had not much strength left. He called for one of his aides. But the buck-toothed boy was dead, and the yellow-haired boy was dead, and the sergeant was down and would never recover. Buford stopped in the cemetery. He could not find the White Angel, but he looked out across the town and he could see a great ocean of rebel campfires flooding the town, with fire burning all over those ridges to the west, flooding fire right up to the base of the hill. Buford took off his hat, looked up to the stars. He said to John Reynolds,
"Well, John, we held the ground."
He wiped his eyes.
He thought, "Have to get some more lieutenants." Then he rode off down the hill into the black beneath the trees.
Thursday, July 2nd, 1863. The second day. He hath loosed the fateful lightning. 1. Fremantle. Awake in the dark. The stars still brightly shining. Fremantle, a slow riser, staggered into the dawn, not quite knowing where he was. These people might conduct these things at a civilized hour. 3 in the morning. Incredible. He washed in dirty water, came vaguely awake. War. The army awakened around him. He could sense the red battle forming today, coming like the sun. His senses shocked him awake. He expected cannon at any moment. He saw the first light of dawn, a dusky rose in the east, the sun coming up from the direction of the enemy. He felt sleepily marvelous. He bid a cheery hello to Sorrel, Longstreet's aide. "Major Sorrel, sir, good morning. I say, could you direct me to the battle?" Sorrel, a neat and natty person, smiled and bowed. "Would you care for a bite to eat before the assault? We can serve Yankees done to order, before or after breakfast." Fremantle could not suppress a yawn, smothered it politely with his hand. "I suppose there is time for a bun or two. How's General Longstreet this morning? My compliments, and I trust he slept well?" "Doubt if he slept at all. He's gone over to speak with General Lee." "Does the man ever sleep? Amazing. He rarely even sits down." Sorrel smiled. A bird, annoyed at being awakened early, began chattering in the tree above him. Other officers began stepping out into the dark of the morning. There was Ross, the fat Austrian with the Scotch name. He was all aglow in the powder-blue uniform of the Austrian Hussars, complete with shining silver chamber pot for the head, waving a blue plume. As he came closer, Fremantle observed with alarm that the man was spotlessly groomed. Even his mustache was waxed, the ends slim and sharp like wiggly rapiers. Ross boomed happily, patting himself fat-handedly across the stomach. "C'est le sanglant appel de Mars, eh, old chap?" He popped the slender Fremantle on the arm, unsettling him. Fremantle said with distaste, "Early in the morning for that, old friend. Could you wait until after tea?" The others were gathering around the breakfast table. Scheibert, the beardless Prussian, moody, prim, was dressed all in white. White coat, floppy white hat, the inevitable glittering monocle. While most of the officers of the army could speak French, few could speak German, and Scheibert's pride was continually offended. But he went on stubbornly using German military terms in conversation, was not understood, would not explain, sat fatly, whitely, to the side. A rare sight, oddly comical in that company. Lawley, the correspondent, seemed ill again, and had not made up his mind whether or not to ride today. There were the 3 medical people, Maury, Cullen, Barksdale, and others of Longstreet's staff, Latrobe, Gorey, and the charming little Jew, Major Moses. They sat down to a splendid breakfast, and although Fremantle continued to wake up slowly, coming alive as the day came alive, warmly, brightly, with no clouds anywhere, the wind beginning to pick up and rustle the trees, the light beginning to sift down through the cool leaves, the dark branches, still Fremantle remained vaguely asleep. The morning at war. Marvelous. Good men around a table. What a joy to be with the winners. All these men had nothing but contempt for the Yankees, whom they had beaten so often. There was even an air of regret at the table, a sense of seize the day, as if these bright moments of good fellowship before battle were numbered, that the war would soon be over and all this would end, and we would all go back to the duller pursuits of peace. Fremantle enjoyed himself enormously. Southerners. They were Englishmen, by George. Fremantle was at home. He ate hot eggs, warm bread, reveled in steaming tea, although the water from which the tea was made left an aftertaste in the mouth, afterthoughts in the brain, from what nearby barn. The men all chatted, joked. Fremantle was sorry to see breakfast end, but the sun was fully up. Now, once more, he could expect the big thunder of cannon.
must not miss it today.
Sorrel promised to keep him informed. They rode together toward the lines, hoping for a good view. So Fremantle came to Gettysburg, saw the bodies unburied in the fields, beginning to become offensive in the heat of the morning, poor chaps. They turned off to the right and rode up through a grove of trees to higher ground, and through the trees Fremantle could already see the Blue Ridge to the east, soft in the morning haze, where the Yankees were camped. But he could see no troops, no movement. He felt his stomach tighten, his breath grow sharp. In the presence of the enemy, in the range of the guns, he passed a battery of Southern artillery, mixed Napoleons and Parrots, served by wagon-stamped USA. Sorrel said, "We get most of our wagons from the enemy, many of the guns. Their artillery is very good, but ours will get better." The Austrian Ross had ridden up beside them. One of the gunners, a lean, barefoot man in dusty brown, stared at him unbelievingly as he passed, then bawled in a piercing voice that carried all along the line, "Hey, mister! You in blue! What do you do, man? You look like you swallowed some mice!" Sorrel put his hand over his mouth. Ross stared back, uncomprehending. Fremantle said cheerily, "The fellow is referring to the waxed mustache, old friend." Ross grumbled, twitched the mustache, stroked the ends lovingly, glowered. They rode to Lee's headquarters, then beyond, up the ridge to where the generals were meeting. There was a gathering of officers, too many men. Sorrel suggested that if Fremantle wanted a good view, he should find a convenient tree. Fremantle wandered forward, with Lawley, through the cool green woods, to the same commanding position he had the day before, climbed the same wide oak. There below him, not 50 feet away, he recognized Longstreet, then Lee. The officers were in consultation. Lee was standing with his back to the group, bareheaded, the white hair flicking in the breeze. He was gazing out toward the Union lines, which were clearly visible in the east. He put his field glasses to his eyes, looked, put them down, walked 2 or 3 paces south, turned, looked again, slowly walked back and forth. Longstreet was sitting on a camp stool, whittling slowly on a stick, making a point, sharpening the point, sharpening, sharpening. A.P. Hill, looking much healthier than the day before, was chatting with another officer, unidentified. Sitting next to Longstreet on a stump, also whittling, was a tall, slim man with an extraordinary face, eyes with a cold glint in them, erect in posture even as he sat, cutting a stick. Fremantle asked, impressed, "Who is that?" "Lawley." "That's Hood. John Bell Hood. They call him Sam, I think. He commands one of Longstreet's divisions. From Texas, I believe."
"Does his behavior in battle match his appearance?"
"He does his job," Lawley said laconically.
"An interesting army," Fremantle said. "Most interesting."
Lee had turned, was saying something to Longstreet. Longstreet shook his head. Hill came closer. Lawley said, "The Yankees have dug in, but I don't see any trenches anywhere here. That means we'll attack." The "we" was inevitable, but Fremantle noticed it.
He felt a part, almost a member of this marvelous group of outnumbered men. Englishmen. They called themselves Americans, but they were transplanted Englishmen. Look at the names. Lee, Hill, Longstreet, Jackson, Stuart, and Lee was Church of England. Most of them were. All gentlemen. No finer gentleman in England than Lee. Well, of course, here and there, possibly one exception. Or two. Nevertheless, they are our people. Proud to have them. And perhaps they will rejoin the Queen, and it will be as it was, as it always should have been.
They had talked of that the evening before,
Every one of the officers had insisted that the South would be happier under the Queen than under the Union.